Good morning, Peter Griffin.
Morning, Catherine. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Plenty on your plate. Shall we start with the Uber case?
Yeah, let's. So, if you're a listener subscriber, you'll see I've been writing about this in the current issue, interviewing a lot of Uber drivers, just a real insight into sort of what a lousy proposition it is being an Uber driver. A lot of the drivers I spoke to, who are essentially self-employed, they're contractors and they pay all their own costs, insurance, gas. Some of them go into debt to buy a car to operate. And some of them are averaging about $16, $17 an hour, which is below minimum wage. But the drivers that I talked to, they're not so much frustrated about that. It's just the total uncertainty dealing with a big platform like Uber. Some of them have been deactivated, allegedly for making abusive comments to passengers, which would be really bad, but there's no process that allows them to defend themselves. A number of drivers that I know of have been booted off the Uber network without an opportunity to say, well, I dispute that and here's my camera footage. So those two factors, the low wage rate and the lack of control, has led two of the large unions, Etu and First Union, to take a case to the employment court on behalf of Uber drivers. And they're effectively asking the court to force Uber to classify drivers as employees. And that would be a game changer for these gig economy type workers, because then they would be able to get minimum wage. They would get holiday pay, sick pay. They may even get KiwiSaver contributions. That would completely change the business model for Uber. It would be very good for their drivers. There's about 6,000 to 7,000 of them around New Zealand. And it's actually something that is starting to happen against Uber's will in other countries like the UK, where the Supreme Court has forced Uber to do exactly that, to give drivers more rights similar to what employees get.
What are some of the challenges going to be in taking that court case? You've talked to a lot of people about this.
Yeah, well, look, as things stand now, a number of lawyers that I've spoken to think that it's going to be an uphill battle for the unions and the drivers. There was a recent case where a driver who was deactivated went to the employment tribunal and argued that he'd been unfairly dismissed, that he didn't have any recourse to argue his case. That was rejected, that argument, by the tribunal. They said, look, you're a contractor, you're not an employee, you don't have an employment contract with Uber. All you have is a service agreement, which Uber has the right to terminate without notice. So that sort of sets a bit of a precedent that Uber has been touting and will likely do so again during this case. But, you know, some lawyers have said, look to the UK. We do have a common basis in law. That UK Supreme Court decision is really important and could be influential here. The difference is that we have a different type of employment structure here in New Zealand. In New Zealand, you're either an employee or you're a contractor. In the UK, there's a third category known as workers. And that category of workers gets some more rights than being a contractor. So the UK Supreme Court said, we want you to treat these drivers as workers. And Uber has since done that for up to 70,000 drivers in the UK. They now do get a certain number of benefits that they didn't get before. But Uber is fighting this in every country, and it's going to be complex in this country. It would be a very big move for the court to rule that Uber should treat sort of workers that look like contractors as employees. That would set a big precedent, and we don't have this third category that would give them some minimum rights. So it will be very complex. It will be hard fought by Uber, but we do have a government that is very big on employment rights at the moment. So there's a lot of political will to make this happen.
What's happening internationally as well with some of these disruptors, and Uber was certainly one of them, because we've seen these moves by the OECD nations on tax and an agreement on a minimum corporate tax. Are we starting to see the beginning of some combined efforts to deal with the disruptors, where they are seen to have taken the disruption too far?
Yeah, well, look, when it comes to the gig economy, the rights that people who do these types of services, and they might be doing cleaning jobs or increasingly home care, where, you know, someone who has a bit of pre-vetting will turn up to do some care for the elderly for a few hours and they're paid on an hourly basis. That's the sort of where the gig economy is going. It's very much sort of unregulated at the moment. And there are sort of class action lawsuits happening all over the world, including in California. Uber's, you know, locked in legal action there, Australia, France, everywhere. So that is carrying on. The other side of it, as you say, is the tax treatment of these platform companies. And if you look at Uber's accounts for 2020 in New Zealand, they declared something like $3.5 million in service fee revenue. Now, we know that Uber is generating probably hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue from all of those rides that are happening 24/7 in seven cities around New Zealand. That's a big business. So where is all of that money going? Well, it's actually going directly to the Netherlands, which is where Uber accounts for and books all of its revenue from subsidiaries around the world. It sends it to the Netherlands because it's a very low tax jurisdiction for Uber. So the OECD, which we're a member of, has just last week got agreement from all of its member countries and nearly 100 other countries to sort of end this practice. So it will introduce a minimum 15% tax rate for the big multinationals like Google, Facebook, and Uber. So our government, in theory, will be able to charge a minimum tax rate here, but also on the revenue that those companies generate in New Zealand. And that's the game changer. So no longer will Uber, in theory, be able to say, we only generate a few million dollars here. They will be taxed on the full sales revenue from this country. The intricacies of that will be interesting to see how that plays out, because these companies are predicated on the concept that they don't have any infrastructure here. They send all of their revenue to a server in the US or somewhere in Europe. How will our Inland Revenue Department be able to get visibility into exactly how much revenue is being generated locally and then charge them the appropriate tax rate? That's still to be worked out, but it definitely is a big step forward, and a lot of economists are saying this could generate an extra $100 billion a year for countries around the world in tax revenue.
All right. Now, Facebook and its subsea cables, it's interesting. We were talking just a couple of days ago with an Australian National University expert on the problems some of the Pacific Islands are having now and having their undersea cable developments canned because they're being done by China. And the concern is around Huawei and any Chinese companies involved in the laying of some of these cables. So what on earth is Facebook's role in subsea cables?
Well, this is interesting, yeah. So there's a lot of geopolitics at the moment around cables that divide between the US and China. We're also seeing the big tech companies, particularly Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Amazon, actually investing billions of dollars in laying cables themselves. I was talking to Facebook's chief technology officer and a few other executives last week, which was sort of awkward timing because they just had a massive global outage of their social network platforms. But they were making the point that they're in the process of laying 150,000 kilometers of cables around the world. There's one cable in particular, it's called To Africa, which is going to be the biggest cable in the world. It goes right around the coast of the African continent, connects dozens of cities. So when that's completed, that will be literally one of the biggest cable projects that's happened. And the reason they're doing this is they want guaranteed bandwidth between all of their data centers around the world. They're increasingly sending more and more data from customers all over the world. They don't want to rely on cables that they don't have a stake in. They've got no control over. They want to be to have money invested in these cables so that they can guarantee access to their data centers. So that, you know, that is a pragmatic thing. The spin-off for that is that the likes of Africa will get three times more bandwidth than it currently has. So that is a good thing. You know, we think of Facebook and its antitrust action against it at the moment and the whistleblower revelations about its insidious business model. All of that is playing out, but there's another story that they are heavily investing in infrastructure that fundamentally is serving their own self-interest, but does have spin-offs for particularly Africa and Asia, where there is currently poor connectivity in a lot of those regions.
What about these issues of trust when it comes to it being a major infrastructure player? Because if there's one issue Facebook has all the time, it is one of trust and motivation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this sort of cable investment could be seen as them doing exactly what they've done in the digital world, which is monopolize everything. I think it's mitigated to some extent when it comes to cables, because they're not buying cables or laying cables themselves. They're generally going in as a syndicate. For instance, the Two Africa cable, they're going in with Vodafone, Telecom Egypt, all of the typical players you would associate with subsea cable infrastructure. So they are a bit player. It's literally too expensive for them to bankroll this all themselves. So they will get some guaranteed bandwidth on these cables, but they don't get to control everything that goes over the cables. But, Facebook did learn a very valuable lesson a few years ago in India when it started offering free internet access to people via the Facebook app. They basically said to poor Indians, if you have a smartphone, you won't have to pay for the internet. Come through the Facebook interface and you will gain access to a number of websites that we agree to offer for free, as well as the Facebook service. They saw that as an altruistic thing that would get millions of people online for the first time. The Indian regulator said, no, thank you. We don't want that. That violates this whole concept of net neutrality, which is that every website should be treated the same way, not just a handful of websites that you want Indians to see. But I think there was a deeper concern there, which is, Indians fundamentally did not want Facebook to be their gateway to the internet. And that was a real naive assumption, I think, on Mark Zuckerberg's part, that people were willing to basically conflate Facebook with the internet itself. They said no, and the strategy has very much changed. It's more about partnership now, beefing up the infrastructure that will ultimately allow more people to get onto Facebook without basically saying to them, we are the new internet ourselves.
Finally, Australia criminalising ransomware. I'm really interested in this. I would have thought it was already a criminal action.
Yeah, technically, I mean, if you extort someone, ransomware, as we know now, is where someone will put malware on your computer. It will lock up your hard drive and your access to applications, which means you can't access all of your really valuable data anymore. Then they will send you a request to pay some money, and they will send a code to unlock your data again. So people all around the world have been paying these ransoms. That is extortion. So if you're caught doing that, you will go to court and you can be charged for it. What Australia has done is set up a plan to introduce specific criminal offences for ransomware. So if you do that sort of thing, there will be a specific charge that you will face. If you deal in the malware that creates ransomware attacks, or if you buy and sell that data that is stolen, you will also face specific charges. They've also introduced a mandatory reporting framework. So if you're a company, a larger company with revenue of $10 million a year or more, you will have to tell the government that you are paying a ransom. They haven't criminalized the paying of ransoms, but they've said you need to report that to us. So they know exactly what sort of criminal activity is actually going on. So this is really big, I think, compared to what we've done here in New Zealand. We're facing a similar onslaught of ransomware attacks here, and we really haven't done too much highly visible to say to hackers, don't mess with us. The Australians are very much more like the Americans and some other countries that are really cracking down on this and introducing specific regulation around it. So, my fear now is that once this is in place, a lot of hackers will go, well, the risk is a lot higher now going after Australian organisations, but it's a bit laxer in New Zealand. Let's target them.
Makes a fair bit of sense to be consistent with Australia on these things, doesn't it? Thanks very much, Peter Griffin, with what has been happening in the world of technology.